exemplified quite well by the map in the Ottawa office of Vice Coordinator Hiram McKenzie, in which the North Pole was centered. Except for the enclave of Europe with its Scandinavian and Icelandic regions, all the Arctic area was within the northern region. Roughly, it could be divided into two major areas. To the left on the map was all of North America above the Rio Grande. To the right was included all of what had once been the Soviet Union. Together, these areas represented the centered power of the planet in the first years of the atomic age. Between the two was Great Britain, a tongue of the region licking at Europe. Up at the top of the map, distorted into odd, huge shapes, were Australia and New Zealand, also member provinces of the region. Not all the changes of the past decades had yet altered the fact that the North was the economic ruler of the planet. There was almost an ostentatious symbolism thereof in the fact that of the official regional maps Byerly had seen, Mackenzie's alone showed all the earth, as though the North feared no competition and needed no favoritism to point up its preeminence. "Impossible," said Mackenzie, dourly, over the whiskey. "Mr. Byerly, you have had no training as a robot technician, I believe."
"No, I have not."
Well, it is, in my opinion, a sad thing that Ching, Ngoma, and Sejachowska haven't either. There is too prevalent an opinion among the peoples of Earth that a coordinator need only be a capable organizer, a broad generalizer, and an amiable person. These days he should know his robotics as well. No offense intended.
None taken. I agree with you.
I take it, for instance, from what you have said already, that you worry about the recent trifling dislocation in world economy.
I don't know what you suspect, but it has happened in the past that people, who should have known better, wondered what would happen if false data were fed into the machine.
And what would happen, Mr. Mackenzie?
Well, the Scotsman shifted his weight and sighed. All collected data goes through a complicated screening system which involves both human and mechanical checking, so that the problem is not likely to arise. But let us ignore that. Humans are fallible, also corruptible, and ordinary mechanical devices are liable to mechanical failure. The real point of the matter is that what we call a wrong datum is one which is inconsistent with all other known data. It is our only criterion of right and wrong. It is the machines as well. Order it, for instance, to direct agricultural activity on the basis of an average July temperature in Iowa of 57 degrees Fahrenheit. It won't accept that. It will not give an answer. Not that it has any prejudice against that particular temperature, or that an answer is impossible, but because in the light of all the other data fed it over a period of years, it knows that the probability of an average July temperature of 57 is virtually nil. It rejects that datum. The only way a wrong datum can be forced on the machine is to include it as part of a self-consistent whole, all of which is subtly wrong in a manner either too delicate for the machine to detect, or outside the machine's experience. The former is beyond human capacity, and the latter is almost so, and is becoming more nearly so as the machine's experience increases by the second.
Stephen Byerly placed two fingers to the bridge of his nose.
Then the machine cannot be tampered with.
And how do you account for recent errors, then?
My dear Byerly, I see that you instinctively follow that great error, that the machine knows all. Let me cite you a case from my personal experience. The cotton industry engages experienced buyers who purchase cotton. Their procedure is to pull a tuft of cotton out of a random bale of a lot. They will look at that tuft and feel it, tease it out, listen to the crackling, perhaps, as they do, touch it with their tongue. And through this procedure, they will determine the class of cotton the bales represent. There are about a dozen such classes. As a result of their decisions, purchases are made at certain prices. Blends are made in certain proportions. Now, these buyers cannot yet be replaced by the machine.
Why not? Surely the data involved is not too complicated for it.
Probably not. But what data is this you refer to? No textile chemist knows exactly what it is that the buyer tests when he feels a tuft of cotton. Presumably there's the average length of the threads, their feel, the extent and nature of their slickness, the way they hang together, and so on. Several dozen items subconsciously weighed out of years of experience. But the quantitative nature of these tests is not known. Maybe even the very nature of some of them is not known. So we have nothing to feed the machine. Nor can the buyers explain their own judgment. They can only say, well, look at it. Can't you tell it's class such and such?
I see. There are innumerable cases like that. The machine is only a tool, after all, which can help humanity progress faster by taking some of the burdens of calculations and interpretations off its back. The task of the human brain remains what it has always been, that of discovering new data to be analyzed, and of devising new concepts to be tested. A pity the Society for Humanity won't understand that.
They are against the machine?
They would be against mathematics or against the art of writing if they had lived at the appropriate time. These reactionaries of the society claim the machine robs man of his soul. I notice that capable men are still at a premium in our society. We still need the man who is intelligent enough to think of the proper questions to ask.
Perhaps if we could find enough of such, these dislocations you worry about, Coordinator, wouldn't occur.
Earth, including the uninhabited continent Antarctica. A. Area. 54 million square miles. Land surface. B. Population. 3,300,000,000. C. Capital. New York. The fire behind the quartz was weary now and sputtered its reluctant way to death. The coordinator was somber, his mood matching the sinking flame.
They all minimize the state of affairs.
His voice was low.
Is it not easy to imagine that they all laugh at me?
And yet, Vincent Silver said the machines cannot be out of order, and I must believe him. Hiram McKenzie says they cannot be fed false data, and I must believe him. But the machines are going wrong somehow, and I must believe that too. And so there is still an alternative left.
He glanced sidewise at Susan Calvin, who, with closed eyes, for a moment seemed asleep.
"What is that?" she asked, prompt to her cue, nevertheless.
"Why, that correct data is indeed given, and correct answers are indeed received, but that they are then ignored. There is no way the machine can enforce obedience to its dictates."
Madam Sedgechowska hinted as much, with reference to Northerners in general, it seems to me.
So she did.
And what purpose is served by disobeying the machine? Let's consider motivations.
It's obvious to me, and should be to you.
It is a matter of rocking the boat, deliberately. There can be no serious conflicts on Earth in which one group or another can seize more power than it has for what it thinks is its own good despite the harm to mankind as a whole, while the machines rule. If popular faith in the machines can be destroyed to the point where they are abandoned, it will be the law of the jungle again. And not one of the four regions can be freed of the suspicion of wanting just that. The East has half of humanity within its borders, and the tropics more than half of Earth's resources. Each can feel itself the natural rulers of all Earth, and each has a history of humiliation by the North, for which it can be human enough to wish a senseless revenge. Europe has a tradition of greatness, on the other hand. It once did rule the Earth, and there is nothing so eternally adhesive as the memory of power.
Yet, in another way, it's hard to believe.
Both the East and the tropics are in a state of enormous expansion within their own borders. Both are climbing incredibly. They cannot have the spare energy for military adventures. And Europe can have nothing but its dreams. It is a cipher, militarily.
So, Stephen, said Susan, you leave the North?
Yes, said Byerly, energetically, I do. The North is now the strongest and has been for nearly a century, or its component parts have been. But it is losing relatively now. The tropic regions may take their place in the forefront of civilization for the first time since the pharaohs.
and there are Northerners who fear that. The Society for Humanity is a Northern organization primarily, you know, and they make no secret of not wanting the machines. Susan, they are few in numbers, but it is an association of powerful men, heads of factories, directors of industries and agricultural combines who hate to be what they call the machine's office boy belong to it. Men with ambition belong to it. Men who feel themselves strong enough to decide for themselves what is best for themselves, and not just to be told what is best for others. In short, just those men who, by together refusing to accept the decisions of the machine, can, in a short time, turn the world topsy-turvy. Just those belong to the society. Susan, it hangs together. Five of the directors of World Steel are members, and World Steel suffers from overproduction. Consolidated Cinnabar, which mined mercury at Almaden, was a northern concern. Its books are still being investigated, but one, at least, of the men concerned was a member. Francisco Villafranca, who single-handed delayed the Mexican Canal for 2 months, was a member. We know already. And so was Rama Vrasayana. I was not at all surprised to find out. Susan said, quietly, "These men, I might point out, have all done badly." "But naturally," interjected Byerly, "to disobey the machine's analyses is to follow a non-optimal path. Results are poorer than they might be. It's the price they pay. They will have it rough now, but in the confusion that will eventually follow..." "Just what do you plan doing, Stephen?" "There is obviously no time to lose. I am going to have the society outlawed, every member removed from any responsible post, and all executive and technical positions henceforward can be filled only by applicants signing a non-society oath. It will mean a certain surrender of basic civil liberties, but I am sure the Congress..." "It won't work." "What? Why not?" "I will make a prediction. If you try any such thing, you will find yourself hampered at every turn. You will find it impossible to carry out. You will find your every move in that direction will result in trouble." Byerly was taken aback. "Why do you say that? I was rather hoping for your approval in this matter. You can't have it as long as your actions are based on a false premise. You admit the machine can't be wrong and can't be fed wrong data. I will now show you that it cannot be disobeyed either, as you think is being done by the society." "That I don't see at all." "Then listen. Every action by any executive which does not follow the exact directions of the machine he is working with becomes part of the data for the next problem. The machine, therefore, knows that the executive has a certain tendency to disobey. He can incorporate that tendency into that data, even quantitatively, that is, judging exactly how much and in what direction disobedience would occur. Its next answers would be just sufficiently biased so that after the executive concerned disobeyed, he would have automatically corrected those answers to optimal directions. The machine knows, Stephen." "You can't be sure of all this. You are guessing." "It is a guess based on a lifetime's experience with robots. You had better rely on such a guess, Stephen." "But then what is left? The machines themselves are correct, and the premises they work on are correct. That we have agreed upon. Now you say that it cannot be disobeyed. Then what is wrong?" "You have answered yourself. Nothing is wrong. Think about the machines for a while, Stephen. They are robots, and they follow the first law. But the machines work not for any single human being, but for all humanity, so that the first law becomes, no machine may harm humanity, or through inaction, allow humanity to come to harm." "Very well, then, Stephen. What harms humanity?" "Economic dislocations, most of all, from whatever cause. Wouldn't you say so?"
"I would."
"And what is most likely in the future to cause economic dislocations?" Answer that, Stephen. I should say, replied Byerly, unwillingly, the destruction of the machines. And so should I say, and so should the machines say. Their first care, therefore, is to preserve themselves for us. And so they are quietly taking care of the only elements left that threaten them. It is not the Society for Humanity which is shaking the boat so that the machines may be destroyed. You have been looking at the reverse of the picture. Say rather that the machine is shaking the boat, very slightly, just enough to shake loose those few which cling to the side for purposes the machines consider harmful to humanity. So, Vrasayana loses his factory and gets another job where he can do no harm. He is not badly hurt. He is not rendered incapable of earning a living, for the machine cannot harm a human being more than minimally, and that only to serve a greater number. Consolidated Cinnabar loses control at Almaden. Villafranca is no longer a civil engineer in charge of an important project. And the directors of World Steel are losing their grip on the industry, or will. But you don't really know all this, insisted Byerly, distractedly. How can we possibly take a chance on your being right? You must. Do you remember the machine's own statement when you presented the problem to him? It was, "The matter admits of no explanation." The machine did not say there was no explanation, or that it could determine no explanation. It simply was not going to admit any explanation. In other words, it would be harmful to humanity to have the explanation known, and that's why we can only guess, and keep on guessing. But how can the explanation do us harm? Assume that you are right, Susan. Why, Stephen, if I am right, it means that the machine is conducting our future for us not only simply in direct answer to our direct questions, but in general answer to the world situation and to human psychology as a whole. And no, that may make us unhappy and may hurt our pride. The machine cannot, must not make us unhappy. Stephen, how do we know what the ultimate good of humanity will entail? We haven't at our disposal the infinite factors that the machine has at its. Perhaps to give you a not unfamiliar example, our entire technical civilization has created more unhappiness and misery than it has removed. Perhaps an agrarian or pastoral civilization with less culture and less people would be better. If so, the machines must move in that direction, preferably without telling us, since in our ignorant prejudices we only know that what we are used to is good, and we would then fight change. Or perhaps a complete urbanization, or a completely caste-ridden society, or complete anarchy is the answer. We don't know. Only the machines know, and they are going there, and taking us with them. But you are telling me, Susan, that the Society for Humanity is right, and that mankind has lost its own say in its future. It never had any, really. It was always at the mercy of economic and sociological forces it did not understand, at the whims of climate and the fortunes of war. Now the machines understand them, and no one can stop them, since the machines will deal with them as they are dealing with the society, having as they do the greatest of weapons at their disposal, the absolute control of our economy. How horrible. Perhaps how wonderful. Think that for all time, all conflicts are finally evitable. Only the machines, from now on, are inevitable. And the fire behind the quartz went out, and only a curl of smoke was left to indicate its place. And that is all, said Dr. Calvin, rising. I saw it from the beginning, when the poor robots couldn't speak to the end, when they stand between mankind and destruction. I will see no more. My life is over. You will see what comes next. I never saw Susan Calvin again. She died last month at the age of 82. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I, Robot by Isaac Asimov. This program was produced and directed by Janet Stark. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 1950 by Isaac Asimov. Production copyright 2004, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.